Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a spectacular show for you this evening. Brian Allen, who did the human-powered flight in the Gossamer Albatross across the English Channel, is here tonight. We're going to learn about that amazing journey, so many things that happened back with the innovations that were taking place there during the energy crisis. It's very, very cool, and there's a little time travel back to the 70s. So really looking forward to bringing him here on the show. Before we get started, just a few things. First of all, everything is booming here at Social Flight, and we are getting ready for Air Venture. So if you're going to be headed out to Oshkosh at Air Venture, then be sure to look for the flags all over at all of our partners there. You will see big flags that have Social Flight on them and identify our partners. They're also everybody that's on this board here behind me, and come in, ask for us. We're going to be rotating around there, and we're running our Snag Some Swag program, where we have mountains of giveaways that we are bringing to Air Venture. If you catch one of us, we still have some of it on us for the day. We would be thrilled to get to meet you in person, to give you one of the swag that we've got, and just thank you for being part of the Social Flight family. In addition, of course, there are tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations in Social Flight, and also our FAA learning system, where we have WINGS programs that you can take for credit with the FAA. We have programs for the aviation maintenance technician, where you can participate in that program and get a lot of technical knowledge. And then also, of course, if you happen to be an AMP with an inspection authorization, you can get your 8 hours of continuing education for your IA renewal for free on your time right in Social Flight. And with that, we also have our Fly to Win challenge. We are about to give away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument glass for your panel. All you need to do is get the Social Flight mobile app, get out there and check in, even if it's just at your home airport. One check-in and you're entered. But if you fly to many airports and compete to get on our leaderboard with more points, you can get extra entries into that drawing and increase your chances of winning. And with that, also I'd like to say tonight's program is brought to us by Lightspeed Aviation and the amazing Delta Zulu headset. We just gave away a Delta Zulu as part of the Fly to Win challenge, and I'll tell you, it is absolutely fantastic. It has the Canary carbon monoxide detection, the hearing acuity customized audio in it, and I will say we discovered a carbon monoxide leak in our own Bonanza as we were getting ready to go into annual by using that headset. It actually alerted us, and we found a hole in the muffler system that we didn't really know about because we had our heating system turned off at the time, but it's a real safety thing. So be sure to check that out. Lots and lots of giveaways and fun stuff. Now to tonight's program. Brian Allen is a renowned American hang glider pilot and cyclist who is best known for his remarkable feats in human-powered flight. He was both the pilot and power plant behind the two aircraft that won the first two Kramer Prizes for human-powered flight, the Gossamer Condor in 1977 and the Gossamer Albatross in 1979, culminating in the amazing feat of crossing the English Channel by air using only human power. During the flight, Brian Allen established two world records, one for straight distance at 22.26 miles and another for duration at 2 hours, 49 minutes. Can you imagine pedaling and staying aloft in an aircraft for that amount of time? It is truly amazing. Well, the oil crisis of the 1970s sparked innovation throughout the automotive world, but it also drew attention from aviation experts, including Dr. Paul McCready, whose mission was to demonstrate what could be possible through human power and then solar power. Brian's story and that of the entire team is one that shows the combination of innovation and dedication and what that can achieve almost anything. I am thrilled to have him with us here tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Brian Allen. Hi, Hi Brian. Jeff. How are you?
I am good. I'm good.
Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. And I want to get out right at the beginning that you're going to be appearing at an event at Minter Field Air Museum. Ron Pierce has organized this, but this Saturday, August 24th, for anybody anywhere nearby, there is a really wonderful event that's celebrating all of the work done there. And so you're going to be out there. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, the actual banquet is going to be done at a place, Hodel's in Bakersfield, and the Minter Field Air Museum that day will be open to the public as well, as I understand it. Hodel's is interesting because that was a place that during the Gossamer Condor, after we had done stuff all day, then we would oftentimes all go to Hodel's because it was this, and still is, this big smorgasbord where you could just go in and get a big plate of food. And of course, they'd see me come in and go, oh no. Here comes the guy that always eats two plates full of food. A great place. The event itself is going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely fantastic. So I'd like to start at the beginning of understanding first about you and your background, because obviously it takes some pretty special skills to have both the athletic ability and the piloting ability to do this. What brought you to aviation and to cycling, and how did that come together for you? And then how were you kind of discovered by Paul in the program?
Yeah, so I mean, as a little kid, I was interested in flying and flew U-Control models and built little plastic models and stuff like that, and read lots of books on aviation, but really wasn't involved in it. My father had his private pilot's license just after the Second World War, but by the time I was around, he had become inactive on that. And so, yeah, I got very much involved in bicycling. And so in high school, I mean, I was doing overnight bicycle trips up to the Sierra Nevada mountains and stuff like that. Always interested in the outdoors, interested in hiking, interested in the aerial environment. And then when I was going to college, then hang gliding kind of came on the scene, and I convinced two of my friends to go in three ways on building a kit for a Rogallo hang glider.
And so you built your first hang glider that you
used. This is true. Yeah, the three of us built it, you know, got all the parts and stuff and put it all together and attempted to get flight instruction. There was one flying school down in Southern California. The weekend we went down there, it rained. So was up in Bakersfield, and so the three of us taught ourselves how to fly.
What kind of guts does it take?
I would not recommend that. Don't do that. That's a bad idea.
I'm going to show a picture of this. What kind of guts does it take to teach yourself, to assemble it yourself, and then to teach yourself how to fly a hang glider? Do you guys draw straws? What's going on here?
Well, that was kind of interesting. And the picture you're showing is my second hang glider. It's a Wills Wing SST. That was much higher performance and much nicer than our first one, which was a standard Rogallo, which is kind of the dart shape sort of thing. We would take turns. And it turned out that just by the luck of the draw, I was a natural pilot. My roommate Sam was pretty good, and our friend Tom wasn't all that good. And so the way it would work would be, I'd do a flight with the glider, and then okay, now it's Sam's turn, and Sam would do a flight, and Tom would try to fly, and 5 times out of 10, bang, he'd break it, and now we have to order replacement parts for the control bar, so we'd be, you know, kind of offline for a couple of weeks. So that had its powerful limitations.
How are you only replacing parts of the hang glider and not parts of yourself?
Well, what you do if you're teaching yourself how to fly any thing is you stay close to the ground. And so initially we were just doing little flights where you'd get maybe 3 feet off the ground and you'd have like a 20 second flight. And so the place that we kind of gravitated to was east of Bakersfield, kind of the bluffs just south of Lake Ming. And those bluffs are about 400 feet high. And so it took us several months to get to the point where we were flying off the top. And I have a horrible story about that. So I had gotten to the point where I'm flying off the top and I'm even soaring the hill when the wind's better. And Sam's flown off the top many times, but Tom was still, you know, kind of down on the lower slopes and still, you know, kind of and bang. So I kind of bludgeoned to Tom and I said, look, Tom, either give this up or not, but you know, what do you want to do? And so he said, okay, I'm going to fly off the top. And the conditions were perfect. And Tom stood there. Now, forgive me, Tom, for telling the story, but it's true. Tom stood there for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Okay. And I'm saying, looks good, Tom. Conditions are still good, Tom. And then he starts to run and he runs down the hill. And it looks like this to me, Jeff. It looks, you know, he takes off. And then I see, well, let's see, I'm going to reverse it around the other way. I need a better model. Okay, let's use this as a wing. Okay, so Tom has taken off, and then I see the underside of the wing. Okay, and he is descending, and I'm saying, Tom, push out, push it. You know, I mean, just screaming at him, push out, push out, push it. And the glider goes faster and faster and faster and faster, and the wing's starting to flutter and stuff. And I'm thinking, I just killed my friend. Oh my God. Oh my God. And he gets down. He makes maybe a, you know, the 400 foot hill. Maybe his flight is like 25 seconds long, super short. He gets just to the point where it's going to be impacted, maybe 50 feet above the ground. And he finally pushes out on the control bar and the nose goes way up in the air. And then the glider is standard regalos are kind of they're okay as far as they don't have a sharp stall, so they're pretty gentle in a stall situation. But anyway, the nose goes up and bang, and of course just totally blows out the control bar. But Tom, other than maybe a couple little scrapes, wasn't hurt. But I felt so bad. It was just like, oh no, oh no. I really thought, you know, that everybody could fly like I could. And that was wrong.
Was that the last time that Tom, please tell me it's the last time he flew.
That was the last time Tom ever flew.
Good. Yeah. And
he just said, okay,
Tom's still with us, right?
I'm done with this. Oh yeah, yeah. And so he was a friend that I crewed for on sailboats quite a bit. And so Tom and I raced a lot. He's an excellent sailor. So he had really good feel for the wind and the environment, stuff like that, but just not in the flying realm.
Yeah.
But yeah, to just, you know, say, oh, come on, Tom, you know, you're going to do this or not? And then suddenly realize, oh no, he's going to die.
Well, fortunately, that had a happy ending. Were you a cyclist at the time as well?
Oh, yeah. I think I mentioned that I had started doing fairly long distance cycling even when I was in high school. And this hang glider stuff, we built the hang glider in 1973. So by that time, I was a junior in college. And had been, you know, a very active cyclist quite a while, many years. And then at the same time in 72 or 73, then I started, I joined a club in Bakersfield, Vincent Cycle Club, and started racing for them. And that's kind of the way cycling worked at the time, was that if you wanted to compete, you had to join a club. And it was very much, you know, amateur restrictions. And so even if you won something, you were not allowed to get any sort of pay. And and the club was not allowed to pay you. You know, it was all, you know, got to keep everybody an amateur sort of thing.
Interesting. So how did you connect? Now you've got the hang gliding experience and the cycling experience. So how do you connect with Paul McCready and the team?
Well, through the hang gliding stuff, Southern California at that time was one of the peak places in the whole world for hang gliding development and flying and et cetera. And so one of the it, maybe the first magazine, it was called originally called Ground Skimmer, and it was the Southern California Hang Gliding Association, and then hang gliding got more popular and it became the United States Hang Gliding Association. But anyway, so I very early on got a subscription and a membership with the Southern California Hang Gliding Association. So it was getting their magazine. And there were articles by various sorts of people I never heard of. And one of them was Paul McCready. And so he published at least a couple of articles in the Ground Skimmer. So I had heard of him that way. Then that brings us forward to like 1976, and my roommate Sam. So we had been roommates in college, and then continued on being roommates afterwards. My roommate says, "Hey, you know that guy that there was that article in the Ground Skimmer? He's doing a human-powered airplane, and it's over in Mojave, and we should go see it." And I said, "Yeah, that sounds cool." We tried a couple times to go over to Mojave. The weather was always bad. It was always like canceled at the last minute and stuff like that, you know, so making phone calls and on and on. Now, Sam knew of Paul McCready professionally. So Paul McCready's company, AeroVironment, had done consulting for the oil company that Sam worked for in Bakersfield. So some air quality analysis and some various sorts of air oil field simulation as far as the aerial environment, all sorts of stuff having to do with they were doing secondary recovery where they'd inject steam into the ground, and then you have the big steam plumes, and you don't want to be polluting the environment. And so AeroVironment had come out and done a bunch of studies to see what the impact was and how to lessen some of the environmental impact. So Sam was professionally familiar with Paul McCready. He had worked with him. And then Paul gives Sam a call and says, "Sam, this flying at Mojave is not working out. It's just windy here all the time. And I know you know about the Southern San Joaquin Valley and its kind of airshed and kind of how all that works. Can you see if you can maybe find a place where maybe we could bring the airplane?" And that's what Sam did. And Sam found that there was this old World War II era hangar up at Minner Field that was basically empty, and it was plenty big enough to accommodate a 100-foot wingspan airplane, which is what the Gossamer Condor had. So in February or so of 1977, then the whole Condor project got moved up to Minner Field.
Wow. And then at that point, Sam was the one working on it? Or was
No, at
when
that
did you
point, I mean,
leave?
Sam and I both had full-time jobs, and Sam had a job with the oil company, and I at the time had a kind of fill-in job at a lumber company, which I was getting kind of tired of, and I was approaching my 1 year anniversary. And in fact, I walked in after a year, I walked to the boss's office and said, "Okay, we get a raise after a year, and I'm worth at least two people here." And my boss admitted, "Oh yeah, you're right." And he said, "Well, but corporate says I can only give you a 25 cent an hour raise." Oh, I thought about it for a little bit and I said, "Fine, I quit." And so February, okay, not only the Condor get moved up there, but also now I have quit my job. So I'm just kind of
You
floating.
became available.
Yeah, but you know, they had a full-time pilot, a guy named Greg Miller, who was an exceptionally talented cyclist. I had heard of him in the cycling community, and he was, you know, I had many more cycling accomplishments in terms of wins and stuff like that than I did. And was he a Cat 1 or a Cat 2? But so I had gotten a couple of wins in second place to get me out of the novice category. So I was a category three rider, but Greg was, you know, I think a cat one. I mean, he was, you know, a serious cyclist. I mean, he was very, very accomplished. So anyway, then a couple of months later, Greg, who's an accomplished cyclist, gets an offer from a team or a group in Belgium, where he could come and race on an amateur team in Belgium and have all of his expenses covered. And I mean, that at the time, that was the way that you got into professional cycling, was that it was all in Europe, and you had to get an offer to go there, and then you'd go and show your chops, you know, do you have what it takes? So he took
that.
So he took that, because the Gossamer Condor was this weird thing that, you know, he'd go up there, the weather's bad. He didn't even have a car either. So MacCready had to travel to where Greg was in Seal Beach, pick him up, drive it, you know, at nighttime up to Shafter, and then Greg would fly the plane and something would break, and okay, and then they'd drive back, and then the next weekend, whatever. Now, you had kind of asked, what was Sam and I and my relationship to the project? And we just became kind of like hangar rats. So we'd go out there and we'd say, what can we do to help? And they say, here, hold this, hold this wire. Oh, okay. Or, we need to open the hangar door. So, you know, push and push on the hangar door. So just kind of just generally hanging out and watching this thing and watching it slowly develop, and occasionally being one of the people that would pick the wreckage up and carry it back to the hangar. And this was all done, all these flights were done basically, you know, right around dawn. Every once in a while, right at sunset, the weather would be okay for flying, but almost all the flying was done right at dawn.
Yeah. And then when did you get promoted to being the pilot?
When Greg told Dr. MacCready that he was going, he got a better offer. And then MacCready's looking around, is like, uh-oh. And then he goes, oh, wait a minute. You know, I think Sam's, who is that guy, Keith? Or he didn't remember my name. But anyway, there's this guy, and he knew that Sam was a hang glider pilot, and he was pretty sure that Sam's roommate was a hang glider pilot and a cyclist. And so Paul called up Sam and said, Sam, Greg has quit. We need a new prime pilot. Somebody with hopefully, you know, both flying experience and a really good cyclist. Do you know anybody? And Sam said, yeah, I think my roommate might be okay. And so I didn't happen to be there at that particular time. I was up visiting my parents a little to the north in Tulare, where I had grown up. And so my father got a phone call from this guy that I think he had heard about this pedal-powered airplane thing. And so I got a note from my dad that said, oh, this Dr. MacCready guy called and wants to ask you if you might want to try, you know, flying, you know, trying out to fly this airplane. Which, of course, I saw this note. Yeah, absolutely. You know, calling back, you know. And,
time to go back to Southern California.
Yeah. Well, and of course, I was living in Bakersfield. But just on that particular occasion, I happened to be a little further north.
So this is the first one, the Condor. Tell me about this aircraft.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, I'm quoted in at least one place where I said, man, it was like pedaling a house. Because, I mean, it did not have the feel of a lightweight, responsive hang glider or a lightweight, responsive bicycle. It was this great big thing. Oh, my gosh. Almost 100-foot wingspan. You had to pedal quite hard to even get it to take off from the ground. So it was interesting. It was like, oh yeah, you know. So Sam and I had seen this thing being flown for a couple of months, and so we were familiar with kind of the operational strategies of it. And the difference in the Condor, when it was at Mojave, it was a single surface wing and had no covering on the fuselage. When it moved to Shafter, they decided we need to make this thing more efficient. So they incorporated a double surface wing and put an aerodynamic fairing around the cockpit.
That's yeah, I mean that is it certainly looks light. That is for sure.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, a
What are the
100-foot
controls
wingspan
like?
airplane that only weighs 70 pounds. Yeah, it's really light. It's really fragile.
What were the controls like inside?
The controls were definitely non-standard. You had basically a stick, initially kind of like a looked like a little airplane yoke sort of thing. And I said, oh, this is extra stuff, and I made it just a single little thing. But a stick that you moved up and down, and that would tilt the front surface, the canard, up and down. So as you kind of pulled the stick down, then the canard went up and pushed it down, and the canard went down. And it also you could twist it from side to side, and that moved some little tiny tabs that were on the tips of the canard, and the canard was just supported at a single place, and so it was free floating, free flying. And so when you would twist it, then these little tabs would make the canard go to the side, and that would, since it's out in front of the airplane, that would kind of start to tow the nose one way or the other.
So
But it turned out
not like a stick.
it turned out that that was an insufficient way to control the airplane, that the airplane would start to get into spiral divergence and, uh-oh, and crash.
So not a stick the way we think about it. Push forward, go down, pull, go back. Nothing like that.
No. And everything was done to try to be as lightweight as possible, to try to make the cable runs as easy as possible. The secret with the Condor was that people finally said, look, we've noticed when the plane's a little out of trim, if the wings are a little twisted, that the plane turns. What if we put a system in to twist the wings, kind of a la Wright Brothers?
Wright Brothers.
And that was done, but the thing that was kind of unexpected was that because of flying at super low speeds, the twist was opposite from the direction that ailerons would normally go. And so when you twist the wing, the wing that was twisted at a higher angle of attack would make more drag, and the plane would turn that way. Okay? So it's just exactly the opposite of what a conventional airplane does in terms of its aileron deflections.
Got it.
And the control stick for that was underneath the seat. Okay, so you're holding on to a stick in your hand. Okay, this is controlling the front canard, and then you're reaching underneath to click this little stick, either forward for a left turn or back for a right turn. So it was all, and you're having to pedal in the midst of all this. So it was all very non-standard.
So, what was the process to learn to fly the aircraft? I noticed one of the images we showed had to do with it being towed.
Yeah, and most of those tow shots are when we take like a fishing scale and say, okay, let's measure the drag of the airplane and how many pounds of drag is it making? But I said the plane was 70 pounds, but the aerodynamicists realized, oh my gosh, there's a lot of air that this plane is moving around, so it responds like it weighs hundreds of pounds, not like it's 70 pounds. So very unresponsive, very slow. It could definitely sneak up on you.
Interesting, definitely. And the whole time you've got to pedal this whole thing.
Right. And the standard thing that happened to a lot of people, because we ended up letting a lot of people fly it, was that they'd pedal, 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 and they're controlling it and stuff like that, and you're shouting at them, and then they go, wow, look, I'm flying, and then they stop pedaling, and now they're doing a landing, which was fine with us because it was kind of like, okay, you got your 15 seconds of flight time there, that's good enough. There
Now,
actually weren't very many people who on their first flight remembered to pedal. It was just a complete sensory overload.
wow. Now, do I understand that there was a crash during that when you were dealing with Condor? when you're flying
Oh, yeah, there's a bunch. And in fact, there's an Academy Award-winning little short film called The Flight of the Gossamer Condor, and it shows one crash in particular where the canard control system came apart. One of the pulleys failed, and so I'm flying along and hit a little tiny bump of turbulence, and suddenly, oh, the stick is disconnected. And so I slam the stick in one direction and slam, like, oh no, the nose is going up, and I'm, oh no, and then now the nose is going down. I'm, oh no, no control over it. And just and in the film you can see just this slow motion kind of crunch, just this whole mess coming down, and me kind of in a heap in the middle.
Wow.
Luckily, since it only flew it at 10 or 12 miles an hour, it was relatively difficult to get injured,
Huh.
but not impossible. And that's one of the other reasons why we never flew it very high.
And that's, I mean, it's interesting. You look at how fragile this looks and what the control system is that you're talking about here, and you think it's what, 75 years after the Wright brothers, and yet you're back to these types of controls and trying to do human-powered flight.
Right. But the whole impetus for all that was that Dr. McCready looked and said, look, if you could take a hang glider, which takes about a horsepower, if you could make it three times as big, nine times the surface area, and keep it the same weight, then it's only going to take a third of a horsepower. So this was just something that he worked out in terms of numbers. Then the real trick was, well, okay, how do you build this thing? And the Gossamer Condor, with having dozens of bracing wires and super lightweight everything, was the result.
So let's talk fast forward. Now you come up, the team, and Paul McCready comes up with the successor being the Albatross.
Okay. Let's see. Stand by. I'm using an older computer, and I need to go get a power brick real quick. I see it right over
Absolutely.
there. I'm gonna
Go
go
ahead.
get it and plug it in. I'll
We'll
be
come back to
right
that.
back. Jeff, I
There we
apologize for
go.
that. I should
Oh, no worries at all.
have thought that through, but this computer that I'm using is kind of a spare one of my wife's,
No
and I'm
worries.
not all that familiar, and so I'm sitting here watching the battery and going, uh-oh. Okay, but we're charged, so we're good.
So fast forward now, and Paul McCready has come up with the successor to the Condor, and that's the Albatross, the Gossamer Albatross, shown
And
here.
it wasn't called that initially.
No, what was it?
It sort of didn't have a name. I mean, people said, oh, let's call it the Condor II. Let's call it this and that. And the name kind of drifted around. So we were, myself and a couple of other people, were building the initial airplane down in Southern California in a shop down in Redondo Beach, and it didn't have a name. And Paul, he was a really interesting guy and occasionally quirky. And so even when the shot that you see here, which is when the Gossamer Albatross first flew at Shafter and doesn't even have its covering on the fuselage yet, didn't have a name, no name. So people were, just, oh, it's the plane, or it's the, it didn't have a name. And then Paul announced that it was going to be called Gossamer Penguin. And we all went, oh no, Penguin? No, you can't be serious. And I mean, we're trying to, I mean, this guy's the boss, right? I mean, he's the project leader. You don't just say, hey, that's stupid. even though you may be thinking that. So, one of the people, I'm looking at the picture, now that's Bill Watson. I think actually the person in the photograph that's just in the distance, but just behind me is Pete Plum. And he had a shop called Wood Wing Specialty, and he rebuilt Stearman wings and all sorts of other wood wings on airplanes and stuff. And he also had a silk screening business. And I said, "Hey, Pete, tell you what, this was kind of my idea. I came up with the art. And I had proposed Gossamer Albatross, and MacCready had heard the poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, where an albatross gets hung around this guy's neck. And so albatross, oh, that's a bad thing, that's bad luck, and et cetera. Well, if you read the poem, you go, no, the guy had the albatross hung around his neck because he killed the albatross because the albatross is good luck. And it was a punishment to hang the dead body of this albatross around the sailor's neck. Anyway, Paul, not big into poetry. I had the poem on my shelf. So I did a little psychological trick and I said, okay. So I talked to Pete and we made up about 10 or 15 or 20 shirts that had silk screened on it, a simple little logo with an albatross flying, and it said Gossamer Albatross and some little waves, very, very simple art. And so MacCready, since he was a full-time businessman, would come up on the weekends. And so we would be doing stuff at Shafter over the weekdays to build the plane and do this, that, and the other thing. And so when MacCready then next came up, we put on these t-shirts. Didn't say anything about it. Just kind of, oh yeah, how's it going, Paul? And he kind of was looking at us, kind of, oh, where'd you get the t-shirts? And, oh, do you want one, Paul? And that was how it got named Gossamer Albatross, was that he finally decided, okay, maybe we'll call it that.
One of the biggest things I noticed with this is it totally changed the position of the pilot and how you were pedaling. What did that mean to your power and your comfort level flying it?
Right. So the initial Gossamer Condor, it used a supine position because it didn't have covering on the fuselage. And as everyone who's ridden bicycles know, if you can, supine bikes are faster than regular upright bikes just because they're a little lower air drag. And so that was a way to not only simplify the drive mechanism, but also decrease the drag of the pilot. But in many, many, many tests, it's been well established that you will produce maybe 3 or 5 or 7% less power in a supine position as opposed to an upright position. So we did a bunch of tests. The guy who was the my coach and kind of the exercise physiologist on both the Gossamer Condor and Gossamer Albatross was Joe Masterpilot, and he was a professor at Cal State Long Beach. And he and I did a bunch of tests where we try different body positions and on and on and on. But to make the pilot be in the best place for the aerodynamic shape of the fuselage, when you've got this 10-foot tall fuselage, which is necessary for structural reasons, because there's wires going to the bottom of that, then it turns out that being completely upright, with maybe just a very slight, lean forward, is the highest power position that you can be in. It's even better, even better than say on a conventional racing bicycle. Conventional racing bicycles, you're kind of hunched over a little bit. That restricts your diaphragm a bit, and there's maybe a 2 or 3% difference between being in the standard kind of road cyclist position versus being in the more upright position that we used in the Albatross. But we were going for, tiny percentages, and so that's what we did. So again, one of these things where everything kind of pointed in one direction, as far as you want to have the pilot at the widest part of the fuselage, where in the case of the Condor, the pilot was kind of a blob at the back. That was more draggy.
What were the controls like? Did they get simplified on the Albatross?
Yeah, all the controls were now in your hands, and you had your hands on them all the time. I was raised right-handed, but I'm really left-handed, and my handwriting shows that my handwriting is terrible. Anyway, so since I was sitting at the airplane, okay, so we needed to have a stick that would control the canard and some sort of a twist mechanism to control the wing twist. And so I had a left-hand stick, which was side to side for tilting the canard, and fore and aft for doing pitch control on the canard. And then another handle on the right side, which had a lock on it and would normally stay locked. And then if you wanted to actually twist the wings to do a big turn, you could click that little catch up and then twist this thing 90 degrees and go in the direction that you twisted, sort of thing. So the controls were fairly normal. And it wasn't until years later I said, why do you put the stick on the left? I don't know. Just felt right at the time.
When it was enclosed, was that a problem given the physical, obviously the physical nature of what you're doing? I mean, when you think about expending that much energy and moisture and heat, what was that like?
Yeah, it was like being in an oven. Now, the fact that most of the time when we'd be doing flights, we'd be doing them right around dawn, meant that minimized the heating inside. But that was always a problem. And so, in fact, in my training, especially for the Albatross, I deliberately trained in very hot circumstances. So sometimes I would ride the exercise bicycle that we had and put my sweats on and put the helmet on really kind of overload myself to try to get my heat tolerance up.
Tell me
So
about
yeah, it was pretty uncomfortable. Yeah.
So tell me about the channel flight. What was that
Oh
like?
boy.
Take me through that.
Well, yeah. So there was this prize to fly from England to France, not the other way around. You had to go from England to France because the guy who put the prize up, Mr. Kremer, was English. And Paul had extensive background in meteorology and really knew weather really well. He was, I mean, not only was he world sailplane champion, his first company was Meteorology Research Incorporated. I mean, he was just, world class in terms of his knowledge. And he went and looked up all the weather data and said, oh, English Channel. Yeah, this may be 2 or 3 days a year, and they're probably in June, where the weather is calm enough to fly, this 10 or 12 mile an hour airplane across the channel. So we knew that, we had this built-in kind of deadline. We got sponsorship from the DuPont company, and suddenly, wow, and now we got a film crew, and now we got all this stuff, and we got extra people, and oh boy, and we're building all these airplanes and stuff like that. But it was just a ticking, tick, tick, tick. Uh-oh, June is coming up real soon, guys. Somebody, and I think it was Jim Burke, found that we could hitch a ride with the Royal Air Force from California to England in April. Because of course the airplanes, were these enormous things, and the Gossamer Albatross was built so that the main wing came into four pieces, but still each piece is like 25 feet long. So it occupied a fairly large sailplane size trailer. And so trying to get three airplanes over to England, oh my gosh. And so anyway, so there was all sorts of stories about, getting stuff over there. And we were still at the point where the longest flight we'd done was 18 minutes. Oh no, catastrophe. We made some changes to the airplane, and probably the biggest one was an MIT designed propeller. Done by this guy named Eugene Larrabee, made the prop, made some other detailed changes to the plane, went out to Harper Dry Lake in California, and I did a flight of 1 hour, 9 minutes, 3 seconds. And to me, that was the key flight in human powered flight. But the film crew didn't even come to document it. Okay, they said, oh, no, we already got footage of you guys flying at Harper Dry Lake, it'll be fine. But to me, that flight still stands out, because to go from 10 or 15 minutes to suddenly go from an hour. If you look at the human power curve, if you can go for an hour, you can go for 4 hours.
Really?
Okay? Oh, yeah. So the power level that's required to ride your bicycle for, say, 2 hours is the same power levels for 4 hours, you know. So if you can put out a certain amount of power, you can go a long time. And it's this kind of curve that kind of, if this is, I should have it on the screen here, but a thing called the Wilkie curve that some physiologists figured out in the 50s. And he noticed, wow, when a person pedals for 10 seconds, they can put out like 2 horsepower. And when they do 30 seconds, maybe 1 horsepower. And when it's 5 minutes, maybe 3/4 horsepower. But then the curve flattens out. And you get to a point where you can continue that power for a long time. So we knew when we were in California, we got to do a 1 hour flight. We got to do it. And we did it. We put the plane in the trailer. We went to Nellis Air Force Base, put it on this RAF airplane, which was there. Blah, everything got shipped there. Oh my God, the trailers didn't fit because it was a big pallet of ammunition. So we had to take all the stuff out of the trailers. And leave the trailers behind and just take the airplanes. What a mess. And then we got to England, and you know, it's just one thing after another sort of thing for a couple of months when we were there in England. So the cross-channel flight was kind of the end of this whole epic of, oh my gosh, just all these completely impossible little situations all kind of adding up, and finally was able to do it. And one thing that a lot of people don't realize was that with the cross-channel flight, the first attempted takeoff failed, and I broke the airplane.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was only the nose wheel. So the place where we took off was very rough concrete. And so I had gone to the lumber yard and gotten some sheets of Masonite, and we kind of taped those together. And okay, this is going to be our takeoff runway sort of thing. But the plane we were using was the original airplane, which had now been crashed, damaged, and repaired 5 times. And during all the repairs, the front wheels were no longer quite in line with one another. I'm exaggerating, but they were kind of slightly out of line. And so when I set the airplane up for the first takeoff attempt, and I started a pedal, and nobody was allowed to do anything other than just kind of balance the wing. You couldn't assist it forward, and started to drift off these sheets of Masonite. And I'm like, oh, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And one of the only bad thing about the new propeller from MIT was that it did not have good thrust power at zero. It was optimized for 12 miles an hour. And boy, at 0 miles an hour, it didn't put out much thrust. So roll off the edge, and I don't have quite enough flight speed to kind of hold the nose up, and bang, and the front wheel goes into a hole and breaks the front wheel. And the crew, you know, is saying, you know, because they see the airplane kind of go, dunk. And they're like, ah, what happened? And I think I broke the front wheel. That's, you know, and my glasses had come flying off and everything. Anyway, so the crew came from the boats that they had already gone to, and, you know, little rubber Zodiac boats, came back up there, and, wow, let's see, where's the duct tape? And let's see, we got an old wheel here, and fixed it in like 45 minutes.
Wow.
Unbelievable. And then I set the airplane up, you know, the runway's going this way, but I set the airplane up kind of at an angle, because I now knew, oh, when it takes off, it goes kind of in this arc. And the second takeoff was successful.
Wow. And then, as I understand it from the images, I was shocked for the beginning, at least, you were really close to the water.
Well, this is not really, that image there is maybe 45 minutes or an hour into the flight. So the whole intent all along was to fly somewhere in the region of 4 to 8 feet above the water. And I had established during that 1 hour flight at Harper Dry Lake in that April that there was maybe a 5 or 6 or 7% difference between flying 4 feet high versus flying 20 feet high. You could really feel, oh yeah, it takes a little more power up here. So the initial, well, the Kramer rules limited you to no more than, I don't know what it was, 50 meters high or something like that. They had a rule kind of for safety purposes. So fairly soon into the flight, the first 5 or 10 minutes, I was down within 4 to 8 feet, and that was a comfortable place. That was where we normally flew the airplane. But as the flight went on, then a whole bunch of things started happening, and the sea surface started to get more waves, and there started to be a headwind. There started to be turbulence. Oh my gosh, a bunch of things started to pile up, and by about an hour and a half into the flight, I mean, things were pretty desperate.
Wow. And then you were able to climb at some point.
And then let's see. Oh yeah, so you can see in this photograph there's a couple. We had four total Zodiac rubber boats, and the guys in the boats, their primary job was to rescue me, save the airplane if possible, and also keep any press boats, because there were something like 30 press boats, keep any press boats back away from the airplane. So we had a pre-planned thing that if I was not able to continue, I would then make it known one way or the other that I was going to climb up to 15 or 20 feet. Then the designated center Zodiac that had Sam and Bill Watson on it would come underneath, and Bill would hook on a tow line on the airplane, and then we'd attempt to either tow it on to France or tow it back to England, or set it down in some sort of controlled way on the water. We'd never practiced that before. But air's funny stuff, and sometimes the atmosphere will be really turbulent down low, and when you have an inversion, then above that inversion, it's really calm. Well, I was going along, and boy, I'm getting in. And you see in the films, okay, oh boy, he's making a steering correction. He's making another steering correction. You can see the canard just kind of dancing around all the time. And that means more power is required. When I climbed up to 20 feet, then suddenly, hey, no turbulence. Wow, if I can just stay up here, I bet I can continue on. Now, in the meantime, we had a communication radio, but the push-to-talk switch had failed after about 20 minutes, and so I can no longer talk to the flight director, who was Sam Doran, my old roommate. But he'd seen me fly enough, and we had also said, well, if something goes wrong with the radio, we'll use this or that hand signal for this or that condition. And so anyway, so for about a minute, once I had climbed up and discovered, wow, a lot smoother up here, the boat below was still trying to hook onto me. And I knew if they touched it with the tow hook, end of the flight. The official observer would have seen that and said, oh, nope, sorry. And so I started, I kind of went over to the side, and the boat's like, eh, coming underneath. And then I went over to the side in the other direction. The boat's eh, went over, and I attempted to yell, no tow. And Sam knew something was going on, and so he pulled his boat over to the side so he could see me, and he said, I think you're avoiding getting a tow, Brian. If that's true, raise your right hand," which was the one with the wing warp. "Raise your right hand above your head." And so I went like this. He said, "Oh, okay." And then he informed the rest of the group, including Dr. McCready, who was out in the navigation boat, kind of leading this whole flotilla, informed the rest of the group, Brian's going to try it up higher now. But he was just having to read my mind. He could know, I could hear him, but he couldn't hear me on the radio because my push-to-talk switch had failed.
Wow. So what
And
was what?
that was after like an hour and a half, an hour and 35 minutes. The flight went for 2 hours and 49 minutes. So you can get some idea of, oh no, this is
Wow.
just like, ah.
You're like halfway into it during this. Was there any point during the flight that I mean, did you feel more and more energy as you went along, or did you know you were going to make it at some point?
All of our training, all of the amount of water that I consumed before takeoff and the amount of water that was in the airplane, we had established that it, at the power level I was going to use, was sufficient for 2 hours. And the flight instrument batteries had a 2 hour lifetime. Everything was planned. It's going to be a 2 hour flight. And when 2 hours came and went, no more water. This is bad. But I'm still pedaling. And then the flight instrument's going to, they're not, the needles are not moving anymore. So everything started to fail. And then after, maybe 2 hours, 15 minutes or so, I started to get a cramp in one muscle group of my leg. And then, and so I started, you know, kind of not putting as much force on that muscle group. You've got basically your calves and your thighs. Mm-hmm. So you got kind of four muscle groups that are participating in your pedaling. Okay, one down. And then it's like, now a cramp in the second muscle group. Two down. And now three. Oh, no, you know. But by that point, now I can start to see the coast. And before that, it was just kind of out in the open ocean. And I so much didn't want to have to ever do that again. Oh, my God. That was, I mean, there were times in the flight when suddenly the chase guys are saying, "You're mushing." Oh, crap. Or, you know, altitude 6 inches gets called out two or three times. I mean, literally, you know, I think the lowest altitude they got to was like 3 inches above the water. Mm-hmm. And there were times out in mid-channel when there were big enough waves where I was literally having to dive at the face of the wave and then just at the last moment kind of go up over the wave, and I'd get a little bump from the wave pushing a little air. Oh, a little tiny bit of lift for like 3 seconds, and then dive at the next wave, and then a little bump. So, oh my God, it was such a mess. Oh, such a mess. And we had, you know, English Channel, most busy shipping lane, at least at that time in the world. So there were a couple of times when we had to deviate the path of the whole flotilla. There were a couple of times when press boats literally got under the wing, and I'm looking out and seeing, you know, big whip antennas that are like within a few feet of tangling up in the wing wires. Jiminy Christmas. I mean, it was...
Wow.
Glad to never do that again.
But you saw the coast. And right, and then...
Yeah, I saw the coast. Sam is encouraging me now. He's almost pleading with me. Come on, we're not very far away. We're maybe less than a mile. We can do this. We can do this. And we came almost to the beach where we had intended to land, but the wind was fairly strong. And so ahead of me was rocks. And I had to fly up the coast against like an 8 mile an hour headwind to get to the sandy beach where I landed. And I looked and I said to my, you know, and I mean, I'm having to work really hard, so I'm not doing any deep thinking, but I'm saying to myself, gonna crash on the rocks. Because the Kremer Prize rules did not specify that the pilot even had to survive. They certainly didn't specify that the pilot must be uninjured on landing, or that the airplane must be non-destroyed. It just said, fly from England to France. Okay. And so as long as you didn't touch the water on the way over, if you crashed on the rocks, you win the Kremer Prize. And if you land in the water, now you got to go back to England and get the backup airplane and try it again. So, yeah, I was seriously considering crashing the rocks and then kind of flying along parallel. And then suddenly the plane kind of veers fairly strongly to the left. And I go bonk with both controls, both the canard and the wing twist to the right. And I hear tick, 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 tick in the left wing. And I knew from previous experience, that's the sound that the tube makes in the spar just before it breaks. I mean, I'd heard that noise before. And it's like, but, you know, oh, here we go. But got through the little gust, and now the plane is back level. And now it's like, oh, everything's okay. Wow. And it was, I mean, I've described to other people, it was like being born. I mean, there was literally like, you know, there was just this big barrier in front of you, and suddenly, zip, and it opened up. Oh,
Wow.
we're going to do this. This is actually going to work. And when I got over the sand, and this is only like 30 or 45 seconds after the almost catastrophe of the left wing almost breaking, I got over the sand, stopped pedaling, and the plane is just floating. It's like, no, we'll just stay up here a while. We'll just stay up here. I was angry at the plane. It was like, damn it, land, come on. I stopped pedaling. Come on. Come on. Come on. And I was, of course, very physiologically stressed at that point. So I mean, time meant something different than it normally means and stuff like that. So it was probably only 5 or 10 seconds of kind of this floating, but to me it felt like half an hour. It was just, oh my gosh.
Wow.
And then when we landed on the beach, then the plane started to tilt a little bit and pop, the left wing broke. What a coincidence. That's the one that just got heavily stressed out there over the water. So
Wow.
it had definitely gotten weakened.
That is amazing. Truly.
The whole thing is grotesquely epic. And I can't claim any sort of responsibility other than, just kind of being one of the many participants in the whole thing. I mentioned leg cramps. I so overextended myself that after the flight for almost a month, I had severe bouts of cramping in my leg, where it'd just be like suddenly, oh, ow, oh, ow, oh, be in a restaurant or ow, and then after 30 seconds or something, like, oh, I'd go away. And that went on for almost a month. So I had super overextended myself.
Oh my goodness. Well, it is amazing, amazing feat. And I would encourage people to, the Gossamer Condor is at the National Air and Space Museum in the mall, and the Gossamer Albatross is out at the Uvarhazy facility. And our good friend, my good friend Phil Soucy, who was RSO on the SR-71, is a docent there. If you happen to be interested in seeing these aircraft, get down to Washington. If you manage to make it out to see the Albatross,
And if you're on the left coast in Seattle, the Gossamer Albatross number 2 is very prominently displayed in the Seattle Museum of Flight. And the
fantastic.
Gossamer Penguin has recently been refound and is still in a trailer, but it's somewhere in Texas. So these airplanes are out there, but yeah, the plane that's on display in Seattle is the nicest. It flew the best. Oh my gosh, the first time I flew it when we were back in the States, I went, why didn't we use this plane? But it was only 95% finished before the cross channel flight. So
Absolutely. Well, it is just fantastic stories. And again, to anyone out there, you have the opportunity of seeing these aircraft. You can also see the SR-71 that that Phil flew, and perhaps meet with him while you're there and get a tour of both aircraft. Brian, we're at the time of the show that I would like to do Social Flight's Fast Five with you, if you have
okay.
so a little bit more time for a quick rundown. So we can get to know you. Does that work for you?
That works for me.
Excellent. Brian Allen, welcome to Social Flight's Fast Five. We've got five quick questions for you to get to know you a little bit better, and how this aviation and cycling world fits into everything that that you've done to advance aviation. So, question number one, you have most of your focus has been on human-powered or unpowered aircraft and hang gliders. Of all of the aircraft that you have had a chance to fly, is there one that's closest to your heart that when you think about it?
Oh, that's a hard one. But I guess I would have to say the White Dwarf, which was a pedal-powered blimp. And I still have multiple world records for distance and duration in that blimp. Now, the human-powered airplanes, they prohibited use of lifting gas, but gosh, I mean, if you're going to do human-powered flight, you should do it with a blimp. You really should.
That's amazing. And to anyone who can see this right now, this is a human-powered blimp, and that's your favorite one, which fortunately we happen to have a picture of. Excellent. Question number two. Of all of the moments that you've had, whether it be hang gliding, human-powered flight, or even powered flight that you did following all of these experiences, was there one moment that was kind of most transformative or most scary or anything that taught you something about either yourself or the aircraft?
Probably out at the Lake Ming Bluffs. I was flying my SST. It was a soarable day, but not real great soaring. One of the characteristics of the SST was that it didn't have very, very powerful roll. So you really had to really wrestle around. And I flew out in front of the hill and some lift. And then I turned back to get back to the ridge lift. And so I'm flying towards the ridge and, with a tailwind. And went to turn to the right, and big gust on the right wing. Oh, I'll turn to the left. Okay. Oh, and here came the hill. And in the last second or so, the last few feet, I looked and I said, "Hello, death." Because I mean, there was nothing I could do, and I mean, the time just kind of went and whammo, and I was knocked out. It crushed my helmet. Some guys came over to see if I was okay, and I said, "Well, can you see my glasses? My glasses had flown off." And I still actually have a little bit of problem with my left sinus, which I think I crushed. So that was that. That's, I mean, lots of, I mean, the flight that I talked about with the Gossamer Albatross out at Harper Dry Lake was just the best. Oh my God, it was so great. But the one that really pops to mind as far as what's the biggest one was just,
wow,
meeting with death. And luckily, death decided maybe not today. And this was before I got involved with the Gossamer Condor.
Fascinating. All right, question number three. If you had the opportunity to go back and re-experience some moment in your life, not to change it, just to be there again and see what that was like for a short period of time, what would that moment be?
The birth of my daughter. Oh. Oh,
that is wonderful. Gee.
You know, I've been so fortunate with stuff. I worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I flew Martian spacecraft. I did all sorts of cool stuff in my life, but nothing beats having a child.
That's wonderful. I love that. All right. Question number four. If there was one thing that you wish you knew back in your teens or 20s that you could go back and give some advice to your younger self, what do you think you'd say?
Oh my God. Well, my mom sent me a book when I was like 60 years old and she was still alive. And it was about Asperger's syndrome. Okay. And I started reading this book and I said, uh-oh, I recognize this. Oh, this sounds familiar. And I'm turning the pages and it's like, oh, wow, this explains a lot of stuff. And so I am self-diagnosed. Asperger, which is an old term now for a variation on autism, and you know, so more neurodivergent sort of thing. And when I kind of clued into that, I said, oh wow, that explains a lot of stuff. No wonder I wasn't popular in high school. No wonder everybody kind of go, why are you doing all this weird stuff? Why do you have these odd obsessions on this, that, and the other thing? You know, you ask that guy a question and he goes, oh yeah, blah, 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 you know, I'll come tumbling all the words. So that's probably the thing. If I could go back and go tap, 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 hey, guess what? That would be useful.
How interesting. Okay, well, question number five. If you could choose anyone alive or dead, anyone in the entire world or history that you could spend an evening with, get a chance to know, who would that be?
Too many choices. Oh my gosh. But I'm just going to choose one. And that would be the person who I visited his gravesite in Amboise in France. And my wife is French, and she grew up about 20 miles away from Amboise, and that is Leonardo da Vinci.
Excellent answer. What a great answer. I love that. Fascinating. Well, Brian, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight
Absolutely.
Live. Your life has been fascinating, and as you alluded to in many of the things you said there, that we could be here for hours. There's so much more to talk about. And hopefully you'll come back. We'll get a chance to talk about some of those other things. But thank you again. And again,
Okay.
to everyone else, be sure to get out there. And if you're near Minter Airfield, go check out that event. If you have an opportunity to go see the aircraft, go check all of those out. And again, Brian, thank you for everything that you've done.
Sure. And there are two films and also two books, Gossamer Odyssey and More with Less. So books and films both are available.
Wonderful. Well, have a great evening and thank you again.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a
Good night.
pleasure. Good night.
And thank all of you for everything that you do to support general aviation as well. We will be back next Tuesday evening. That is July 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, as always. And we are going to be joined by Aspen Avionics President and CEO John Uzugai as they celebrate their 20th anniversary. They have news for Oshkosh, all sorts of great things happening. And so please join us for that show. And then, of course, we're off for Oshkosh, and we are going to have a great re-entry show after Oshkosh. We are coming back on Tuesday, July 30th, with Arielle Tuito from Flying Wild Alaska. She's coming back on the show. We love her so much. Going to do a show honoring her father that passed away last year, and also talking about her family and so many things with Alaskan flying. So that is, to be sure, a great show. And of course, again, if you are going to be at AirVenture 2024 this year, be sure to find us. Go to any one of our partners, look for the Social Flight flags, track us down. We've got swag for you. We would love to meet you. And I just want to thank all of you personally for being part of the Social Flight community. Until next time, I wish you all blue skies.